we've just seen now that even the mighty Gulf of Alaska, how fragile it actually is, when all you got to do is warm it up.
The warm water blob has Gulf of Alaska cod populations at their lowest. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 25th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, state officials are trying to update Alaska's election system.
One of the guiding principles of the group is that if it doesn't work for rural Alaska, it won't work for Alaska. And so we've been very cognizant of that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Democrats in the U.S. House are urging President Trump to give fishermen caught in the trade war with China the same benefits announced yesterday for farmers. The Trump administration says it will provide $12 billion in emergency aid to American farmers. Producers of soy and other crops are facing stiff taxes on products they send to China now that China has retaliated in response to Trump's first round of tariffs. Senator Lisa Murkowski issued a statement yesterday calling the aid to farmers an admission that tariffs are hurting the country. She said American fishermen are also caught in the crossfire. Four U.S. House Democrats, including the top Democrat on the House Natural Resources Committee, sent a letter today addressed to the President and the Commerce Secretary. They say America's fishermen are hurt coming and going. First, they wrote, fishermen were disadvantaged by the U.S. tariff on imported steel and aluminum, which raises the cost of boats, crab traps, and other metal gear. Now, China has slapped a 25% retaliatory tariff on American seafood. Alaska companies export about $1 billion worth of seafood to China annually. Well, Alaska fishermen have worried for years that climate change would threaten their livelihoods. Now it looks like they were right. The cod population in the Gulf of Alaska is at its lowest level on record. The culprit is the blob, a warm water mass that churned in the ocean for more than 3 years. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Annie Fite has this story as a preview of our upcoming podcast series, The Big Thaw.
Darius Kasperzak has mostly given up on finding cod, but on a calm day in early May, he offers to take me out to show me where he used to catch fish.
Oh, you know what? That might be something.
We're in a bay right near Kodiak. Kasperzak looks at his echo sounder screen and sees a dense cluster of dots on the ocean bottom.
Okay, let's drop on it. That looks pretty darn good. That looks real good, actually.
He kills the engine, leaps onto the deck, and lowers one of his fishing lines into the water. And then, nothing.
There, you can see that line coming up. That's the weight coming up.
Kasperzak has gotten used to his fishing lines coming up empty. Between 2013 and 2017, a warmer-than-normal mass of water, called the blob, occupied a huge swath of the Pacific. At its peak, it stretched from Alaska to South America. In the Gulf of Alaska, the cod population plummeted by more than 80%. Climate change didn't cause the blob all on its own, but scientists say global warming made it worse. Kasperzak says he used to think the rich ocean ecosystem he fishes was unshakable.
But we were always a little bit arrogant in that, you know, this is the Gulf of Alaska, and there is no other place like the Gulf of Alaska. It's just so rich. You can fish this hard, man. We've just seen now that even the mighty Gulf of Alaska, how fragile it actually is, when all you got to do is warm it up. You don't even warm it up that much, a couple degrees. It doesn't take that much.
Now the temperature in the Gulf of Alaska has returned to close to normal. And everyone in Kodiak is asking, will the cod come back?
There's all kinds of information you can get sort of over time once you catch the fish.
Mike Litzau is trying to answer that question. He's a fisheries biologist who works for the University of Alaska and is based in Kodiak. He stands in shallow water on Long Island near Kodiak and uses a net called a beach seine to sweep up fish hiding in the eelgrass and kelp beds.
Some sculpins, another greenlean, another greenlean.
No cod in this net, but by the end of the summer, Mike hopes to catch enough tiny cod to provide clues to how the fish are doing and whether they'll recover. He already has a guess, though. He doesn't think cod will rebound. Litzau says it's too soon to know for sure. That's why he's out in the field doing the science. But he thinks the cod decline may have been too much for the fish to recover from. Other fish might fill the place in the ecosystem cod used to occupy.
When you push a population down really hard, the resources that that population used to rely on can be exploited by other populations. You know, other species can sort of fill that niche and start consuming those food sources and can build up to a point where the population that was driven down can't compete adequately to recover.
Other scientists are more optimistic about cod. But everyone seems to agree on one point. The blob and the warmth that came with it is a kind of dress rehearsal for the future with climate change. Because one thing that is absolutely certain is that the ocean will warm. As one scientist put it, ocean temperatures have nowhere to go but up. And marine heat waves are expected to happen more often, not just in the Gulf of Alaska, but around the world. Litzau says it's really hard to predict what kind of ripple effects that will have.
If in 2014, when the warm blob was starting, if you had said to a bunch of biologists, okay, the Gulf of Alaska is going to be 2 degrees, a degree and a half, or 2 degrees warmer than normal for a whole year, what's going to do well, what's going to do poorly? It would just be like drawing names out of a hat. You know, it's not like all the scientists would say cod are going to be the ones that collapse.
Litzau says we have to get used to the idea of more frequent shocks to the ocean ecosystem. Those changes aren't all bad. When one species declines, others do well. Right now, sablefish are booming in the Gulf of Alaska.
So we'll look out around the green can here. There's this gut going out. And that'll be our last chance for cod. If we don't
out in the Gulf of Alaska, Darius Kasperzak has been looking for cod for about 4 hours. We've seen a few otters, some more puffins, even a whale, but no cod. Eventually, he gives up. Now he just wants a few fish for dinner, some dusky rockfish.
Yay! We got a dusky!
Nice.
We got dinner! Woohoo!
That's a big one, too.
Kasperzak fills a blue tote full of rockfish on ice.
All right, and then we can go home now.
Rockfish used to help Kasperzak supplement his cod earnings. Now it's his main fishery. It doesn't come close to making up for the cod income he's lost, but he's working with a local nonprofit to market rockfish directly to customers to get a better price for the fish. Kasperzak says he can't believe how fast climate change has altered his life. He says he didn't even know it was an issue until he watched Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth in 2006.
And even then I thought, well, you know, maybe they're overblowing or this or that. That was literally only 12 years ago I even became aware of the basic concept. A dozen years later, not only is it real, but the climate has warmed so much and the oceans have absorbed so much heat. I mean, my industry is gone because of it.
Kasperzak is looking at other career options, but he says he wants to stay in Kodiak as long as he can. That way, if the cod do come back, he'll be one of the first ones out on the water. With help from Mitch Borden in Kodiak, I'm Annie Feit.
This story is part of a new season of the podcast Midnight Oil from Alaska's Energy Desk. Season 2 is called The Big Thaw and looks at climate change in Alaska. New episodes begin August 9th. Subscribe to The Big Thaw wherever you get your podcasts. The Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation still prefers Nikiski over Port McKenzie as the terminus for a proposed natural gas pipeline. That's according to an analysis the AGDC recently sent to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The review came after a Matanuska-Susitna Borough complaint to FERC that its port had been overlooked as an alternative. But the FERC-ordered review identified problems with Port McKenzie that the Gas Line Corporation says are not present in the plan to build a liquefaction plant and other facilities in Nikiski. Among them, the AGDC review says are issues with Port McKenzie's greater tidal range, heavier buildup of ice, and more potential for disturbing endangered Cook Inlet belugas. The Gas Line Corporation also says land at the port that the borough has identified for a liquefaction plant is not suitable and would conflict with other development plans for the port's future use. In its own letter to FERC, the Matsu Borough says it disagrees with some of the AGDC's findings and plans to file further comments highlighting what it calls incorrect information in the Gas Line Corporation's review. The state's election equipment and software is outdated. Along with considering a replacement, state officials are looking at a new election system in which many more voters would cast their votes by mail. But rural Alaskans don't want a system that entirely relies on mail. A work group that's advising Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott on election policy met by phone today to talk about possible changes to the system. Vergine Hanna of the Institute of Social and Economic Research, or ICER, presented survey results from Southwest Alaska. Residents there prefer the current system, but are open to having the option of voting by mail once they hear more about it.
Not surprisingly, the more dissatisfied they were with the mail service, the more likely they were to respond that they wanted to keep voting the way it is now.
Any changes would not happen this year. State officials are aiming to replace the equipment and software by the elections in 2020. If the new system is like that used by Anchorage this year, all voters would receive their ballots in the mail. They would have a choice whether to return them by mail or take them to a polling place. The state hired the consulting company Resource Data to advise the Division of Elections on potential changes to state law that would allow more voting by mail. Dennis Wheeler is leading this work.
Just as an example, currently on the books is a statute that says the division director can hold elections by mail as long as they're not coinciding with the primary or any municipal election. So obviously that's a hurdle that makes vote by mail not much of an option at this point.
State officials say one of their goals is to maximize the accessibility of the voting system. The first Anchorage municipal election that was primarily vote by mail had the highest voter turnout of the past decade. Division Director Josie Banke says the state must replace its outdated equipment. She says any change to the current voting system must work well across the state. That's why the state asked ICER to survey Southwest Alaska.
One of the guiding principles of the group is that if it doesn't work for rural Alaska, it won't work for Alaska. And so we've been very cognizant of that.
The overall cost of replacing the election equipment and software is nearly $5 million. The state has received a $3 million grant from the federal government to replace them. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, crews take to the air to fight an interior wildfire.
That becomes a major operation when you're dealing with, you know, 60 firefighters, three different crews that need to be shuttled in.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Searchers are looking for a missing crew member from a Petersburg-based commercial fishing boat that capsized and sank in Nushagak Bay close to Dillingham this morning. The 58-foot Saner and longliner Pacific Knight capsized and sank near Clark's Point. The boat had been tendering salmon in Bristol Bay this summer. The Pacific Knight is registered to a corporation called Lone Fisherman. According to the Coast Guard, two people were rescued from the water by the Good Samaritan vessel Amanda C. and transferred to the Alaska State Troopers at the scene. The troopers say three people were on board the vessel when it went down. 31-year-old Jeb Phillips of Petersburg and a teenaged male crew member were able to escape. 59-year-old John Phillips of Juneau is still missing. It is unknown whether he was wearing a personal flotation device. A helicopter with Coast Guard Air Station Kodiak was on scene today searching for Phillips along with the troopers and Good Samaritan vessels. The body of a fisherman who fell overboard on Monday in Togiak Bay was found yesterday. According to Alaska State Troopers, Anthony Active, a 39-year-old from Togiak, fell from a 26-foot boat while checking a set net Monday afternoon. The captain of the boat attempted to rescue Active and fell into the water as well. The captain was able to swim to shore and wave down a passing fisherman. Alaska State Troopers, the United States Coast Guard, and a local rescue effort searched for Active by air and land. His body was found at 11:30 yesterday morning. It had washed onto the beach about 7 miles southwest from Togiak Village. Active's next of kin have been notified and his remains are being transported to Anchorage to the state medical examiner. This is the second fisherman to fall overboard in Bristol Bay in less than a week. On Thursday, Grant Hildreth Jr. fell off the FV Cape Gregg in Ugashik. The search for Hildreth was suspended on Friday afternoon. Hot, dry weather in the interior is bringing wildfires to life. The Texalda Hill Fire near Toke is estimated at 4,700 acres after starting Monday by an unknown cause. It's burning on Tetlin Village Corporation land, and State Forestry spokesperson Tim Mowry says yesterday was spent assessing what's at risk. Mowry says three crews were assigned to the fire, and getting them into the locations targeted for protection requires helicopter transport.
That becomes a major operation when you're dealing with, you know, 60 firefighters, three different crews that need to be shuttled in.
Two other fires are also getting attention. An Alaska Fire Service crew is working the 25-acre Hughes Mountain fire. Alaska Fire Service spokesperson Beth Ibsen says it's burning in volatile black spruce about 4 miles from the village of Hughes.
There's a continuous fuel in between the fire and Hughes. Even though the village of Hughes is on the other side of the river, we just don't want to risk it.
Firefighters are also back on the long-burning Zitziana River fire south of Manly Hot Springs. Since early June, they've battled the lightning-caused blaze, which has now consumed nearly 47,000 acres. Ibsen says that includes a 20,000-acre run Monday and Tuesday toward Kindamina Lake, where there are cabins and protection measures have been a priority for weeks.
All the cabins on the east side, we've put in protection measures. You know, they've got black line around the cabins, so they're safe. And now we're working on the west side and putting black line around the cabins on the west side. We feel that we're in a good spot right now to where we don't have to worry about the structures around Kindamina Lake.
Crews are also tracking several lightning-caused wildfires in the Yukon-Charley River's National Preserve. Ibsen says they're working one of the blazes known as the Dome Creek Fire. She says firefighters are focused on protecting the Coal Creek mining camp 65 miles northwest of Eagle.
Doing structure protection because there's a lot of historical cabins.
The National Park Service has closed its Coal Creek and Slavin's Roadhouse facilities while firefighters are using it to stage operations. You'd think with all those glaciers melting around southeast Alaska, sea levels would be rising. But that's not the case. Some parts of the region are actually gaining ground at a pretty astounding pace. And as the tide line moves, a protected wetland in Juneau is shrinking. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has the story.
The view from Frank Rue's house overlooking the Mindenhall Wetland State Game Refuge didn't always look like this. He lives in a neighborhood called Sunny Point, but he says his kids used to come in from playing outside covered in mud.
The story was, and I don't know if it's true, that it was originally called Mud Point because there was a lot more mud out here and even a gravel beach, and then it was renamed Sunny Point.
Sunny Point sounds like a safer real estate investment. And today, nearly 30 years later, the neighborhood mostly lives up to that namesake. From Rue's back porch, you can see a field of long grass that stretches across to the Gastineau Channel. The tide only makes it to this spot below Rue's house a couple of times a year. So technically, this is still a wetland.
You know, I see ducks using these little ponds here all the time. Eagles are using this edge to hunt.
But the land right outside Rue's house is fairly new. And there's a geologic explanation for why it's changed so much since his kids were small. Juneau is rising by about a half an inch a year. The uplift differs from place to place, but region-wide, overall.
That's fast. That's really fast. As far as we know, it's some of the fastest rates. These are the fastest rates in the world.
That's Roman Motika, a retired glaciologist from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Motika says what's causing the land to rise up is a phenomenon known as isostatic rebound. As glaciers retreat, the absence of pressure from the ice causes the land to spring up.
You know, all I have to do is walk out to Mindenhall Glacier and you can see what's going on. So me as a glaciologist, that's sad to see my per glaciers wasting away, but that seems to be the future.
Motika says when researchers first started looking at this back in the 1960s, they thought that isostatic rebound was likely due to the glacial melt, which occurred hundreds of years ago. But today, the scientific models suggest it's also happening now.
Isostatic rebound, in this case, is directly related to climate change.
As the tide line moves farther back from places like Sunny Point, property owners like Frank Rue from before can go through a legal process with the state, essentially claiming ownership over these new lands. Normally, the state owns everything up to the ordinary tide line. But with rebound, those tide lines shift.
Okay, see the two stakes down there with the orange flagging?
Yes. Rue points to his new property boundary. Together with his neighbor, he was able to claim 9 acres of the new land. But he's not keeping it. He's selling it to the Southeast Alaska Land Trust, a conservation group that plans to make this new land part of the Mindenhall Wetlands. Allison Gillum is the group's director.
Our long-term plan has been to give them back to the state, reincorporate them into the refuge, and basically preserve the refuge so future landowners can't continue to take land out of the refuge and continue to make the refuge smaller.
In fact, Gillum says the Mendenhall Refuge could become bigger than its original acreage. Her group has been able to procure some land that wasn't part of the old boundary. And in a couple of years, pending the approval of the Alaska legislature, all of this wetland could be protected, in some cases, once again. Frank Rue's kids may not come back with muddy boots anymore, but he thinks this refuge is still ecologically important for birds and people alike. Even after he's gone, no one will be able to build here.
That was my concern. I don't plan to do anything, but I don't know what the next owner after that would do.
But now, all of the homes along Sunny Point will be able to enjoy their view and have protected wetlands as their backyard. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium featured open positions include CMAs and LPNs for their primary care clinics in Southeast Alaska. Come work for Search and contribute to your community. Enjoy full benefits, paid time off, and retirement savings. Search is looking for someone like you. For more information, visit search.org/jobs. That's search.org/jobs to apply. This message is sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
The island of Afognak near Kodiak was devastated by the 1964 Good Friday earthquake, which scattered its indigenous people to other parts of Alaska and the lower 48. Many lost touch with their culture and language, but as Daisha Eaton with KMXT reports, today Afognak descendants are making sure a new generation has a connection to Aleutic culture, language, and to the land where their ancestors lived.
Two young Alaska Native women who work at a nearby weir counting fish during summer are teaching the kids at this camp about salmon.
How many species of salmon are there?
Five.
Can you name them?
Red salmon.
This is Dig Afognak on Afognak Island, and it's a kids' cultural camp.
That's Talitha Gertz, who spent the past 7 summers working at the camp, which was previously the site of an archaeological dig, and before that, the home of her ancestors. The village was destroyed after the 1964 earthquake and tsunami.
After the earthquake and tidal wave, they decided not to rebuild on Afognak, and some of the villagers went to Port Lyons, and the rest dispersed throughout the United States, Kodiak, and Alaska. To me, I've realized that Dig Afognak, it's a place where we can all come together and talk about those original roots of Afognak.
The land on which the camp sits was owned by Afognak Native Corporation, and after an archaeological dig was completed, the camp was turned over to the tribe, and later the land was donated as well. Then Native Village of Afognak turned it into the kids' cultural camp. They host 4-week-long camps with themes like subsistence hunting and survival skills and Aleutic music and dance and language immersion. Kids, Native and non-Native alike, learn about science, the arts, and the outdoors through the lens of Aleutic culture. Gertz says visiting the place where her ancestors once lived helps her feel connected, and she says it's also important for her 3 kids. 16-year-old Skylar Gertz is the oldest.
If it wasn't for this camp, I probably would have been completely oblivious to who I am, I guess.
With light hair and eyes, she says growing up in Kodiak, people didn't always recognize her Native identity. But at the summer camps, she feels like she's part of a big family. Now she works here as an intern, helping out in the kitchen and mentoring younger campers. Sometimes she tags along to help out on excursions, to forage for plants, or to hunt and fish. It also immerses campers in the Aleutic language. Signs with Aleutic words for household items are posted around the camp. Susan Malutin teaches Aleutic culture and language at the camp.
The language is a big part of it because as we learn the language and go into the different concepts, we learn about tradition, why this word is what it is, when it was used by the elders, the different kinds of ceremonies they had, the different kind of family structures they had. And these words describe those things, and they learn those things.
Nancy Nelson is the camp manager. She says the camp is critical for boosting the next generation's skills and confidence.
It's mostly building their self-esteem, making them have that self-confidence in themselves because they're our future leaders.
James Dunham is a member of the Afognak Tribal Council, which he says views the development of the camp as one of their most important accomplishments. Dunham says the camp is very important to him because, like many Afognak descendants, his grandchildren are growing up in the lower 48, and he doesn't want them to forget their roots.
We want to make sure our kids are able to hold their head up and be proud of who they are and where they come from.
And it seems to be working. Skylar Gertz, whose mother is a descendant but whose father isn't, says she cannot participate in some cultural activities like hunting for otters and seals during camp because of the way the government defines her eligibility through blood quantum. However, she says the camp has taught her to feel confident in who she is.
Being Native isn't about how much Native you are, it's just about your ancestors and how you live up to that today.
Dig Afognak summer camps run through the end of July. On Afognak Island, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Nome Nugget newspaper is officially under new ownership. As of last week, managing editor Deanna Hecker and her husband advertising manager Niels Hahn now own the Nome-based newspaper. The pair purchased the Nugget from the estate of Nancy McGuire, who owned, published, and edited the paper from 1982 until her death in 2016. Hecker has worked for the Nugget as a reporter and later editor since 2002. Hahn joined the staff in 2012. Hecker says she got her start in reporting when she was 20 years old and attending school in Frankfurt, Germany, near where she grew up. Since then, she's worked in TV, radio, and at magazines and newspapers. But she says the independently owned Nugget is, quote, a reporter's dream because of its nature as a community newspaper.
You are embedded in the community, you live in the community, and you report on the important things that affect the community. So we're not having to obey any corporation rules that could sometimes skew reality.
She says she sees herself as a caretaker of the paper during what she calls a significant time for the Arctic.
In the spotlight because of climate change. So we're right here at ground zero of reporting on Arctic issues. We are here, and we report right from here.
The Nome Nugget is one of Alaska's oldest newspapers, with continuous publication since 1899. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Annie Fite in Kodiak, Daisha Eaton on Afognak Island, and Gabe Colombo in Nome. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. We had music tonight from the band Harm, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.